I remember sitting there on the other side of the table saying, I see negative, I see negative. And then all of a sudden, I found out I was BRCA2 positive and felt that now my life has changed and I needed to get moving forward on having a family and becoming a mom so I could nurse my children and then go ahead and take preventative action so I could avoid getting cancer and I could catch it before it caught me. I felt like I was alone. I felt very isolated. None of my friends, you know, were BRCA positive. Nobody in my community spoke about it. I started this group to help other women so they wouldn't get the feeling that I got.
Genetics isn't always black and white, and the emotions and decisions surrounding genetic testing can be even more complex. Welcome to Patient Stories with Gray Genetics. I'm Eleanor Griffith, a certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, a telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service. It seems like there are constantly headlines in the news about genetics, but few news stories focus on the patient experience. At Gray Genetics, we are collecting patient stories, your stories. Every other Tuesday, we share an interview with a patient or a genetic counselor.
It was probably one of the worst feelings I've had in my entire life. Going in, sitting in an MRI machine every 6 months, you know, it caused such stress. I was sick to my stomach days before. I had migraines. I was developing super bad anxiety. It was always the what ifs. Then those what ifs added up and caused so much stress on my body physically and mentally and emotionally. I really wasn't ready to get married at 21 years old. A year and a half after my diagnosis, I got engaged, got married, had two children, and then about a year and a half after my mastectomy, decided that I wanted to go ahead and get a divorce. I mean, I'll never forget hanging up with the genetic counselor, Lily. I was like, I'm floored right now. Like, I wish that I was given this advice and all this information, you know, prior to doing what I did.
Tracy Milgram-Posner is a BRCA2 previvor and the founder and president of BRCA Strong, a 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to support, educate, inspire, and empower previvors and survivors to eliminate the feeling of isolation and help them feel whole again. BRCA Strong strives to alleviate the emotional and financial burdens of women who are genetically predisposed to breast and/or ovarian cancer risk through advocacy, direct assistance, empowerment, fundraising initiatives, and events. Thank you so much for speaking with me. So Tracy, when you were 21 years old, you had genetic testing done and learned that you carry a mutation in the BRCA2 gene. What led you to have that testing done?
So I got tested at the age of 21 after having a lumpectomy at the age of 18. After graduating high school, I did a self-breast exam and found a lump, which came back benign. And then at the age of 19, I found another lump, had a lumpectomy, which came back benign as well. And then the age of 21, after being screened from 19 to 21, they found another lump that they wanted to biopsy. And I said that I was not okay with biopsying unless they had some more information or felt that it was cancerous. And at that time, my breast surgeon decided that since I'm Ashkenazi Jew descent and had a very long family history of cancer, not only breast cancer, lung cancer, and prostate cancer, to go ahead and do genetic testing.
Did that surgeon order testing for you, or did he refer you to a genetic counselor, or how did you actually get that done?
So that my breast surgeon did order my testing. I went to a local hospital in Fort Lauderdale and saw a video from Myriad. After the video, about 6 weeks later, I went in and got my results. My breast surgeon was supposed to be there and unfortunately got called to surgery, and I was given my results by a RN.
Okay. And your mom went with you to that appointment to get your results. Is that right?
That is so.
What do you remember about getting those results?
I remember sitting there on the other side of the table saying, I see negative. I see negative. And then all of a sudden, I found out I was BRCA2 positive and felt that now my life has changed and I needed to get moving forward on having a family and becoming a mom so I could nurse my children and then go ahead and take preventative action so I could avoid getting cancer and I could catch it before it caught me.
Yeah. And you're Ashkenazi Jewish on both sides of your family, but most of the cancer is actually on your mom's side of the family. Is that right?
That is correct.
and your mom hasn't wanted to get tested. How did she react to the news of your positive test result, given that I think she doesn't really want to know that information for herself, even though now maybe she does through knowing your results?
So my mom was very emotionally destroyed. You know, she felt that she gave me the gene and felt that she didn't want to get tested because she wasn't going to take preventative action. She felt that she would just do her screenings, very supportive in what I wanted to do. You know, over 2 to 3 weeks after me having my positive test result, I said, Mom, this is what I want. This is how I'm going to go about it. And she said, I support you 100%, but I'm not doing that test no matter what you do to me.
Yeah.
She felt that, you know, she's not strong enough to handle that result and didn't want to take preventative action and just felt she would just doing screening was good enough for her.
Do you have siblings who also did testing after you tested positive or other family members?
I do have other family members. My uncle, my mom's brother, was tested and he was negative. I actually do have a second cousin who's BRCA2 positive like myself, along two second cousins that are BRCA2 positive.
And that's on your mom's side, both of them?
That's on my mother's side. It's my mom's mom's sister who passed away of breast cancer. Her children have it and their children have it.
Right. Okay. And you mentioned like when you got the results, you felt like, you know, you needed to kind of hurry up and have children so you could move on to do preventative surgeries later on. And a lot of young women with BRCA mutations, I think, feel that pressure. But it's not necessarily easy to just like find a partner and make it happen. but it seems like that actually worked out for you. Is that right? Were you already dating someone in a serious relationship or how did that go for you?
I was dating somebody for a little bit. Wasn't really sure what I wanted. I really wasn't ready to get married at 21 years old. You know, I wanted to live life to the fullest, but felt that being diagnosed with the BRCA2 mutation and the chances after losing an aunt in her young 40s were so high that I felt pressure to go ahead, get married, have children, nurse my kids. So about a year and a half after my diagnosis, I got engaged, got married, had two children. And then about a year and a half after my mastectomy, decided that I wanted to go ahead and get a divorce, which was not an easy decision, knowing what I had been through, knowing I lost one of, you know, my most feminine part of my body at that time. You know, my breast surgeon was not able to keep my nipples. He felt that the chance of cancer reoccurring in there after having a mastectomy was too high. So that was quite a transition from, you know, being married, going through a mastectomy, hysterectomy, going through the changes to now being a single mom of two. I was blessed about a year ago to meet my better half, who has been so supportive through my journey, has so understanding, so caring. You know, I met him and he had no idea about the BRCA mutation. He had no idea, you know, what life was like or how do I explain to him? You know, I wasn't able to keep my nipples. I have implants. I have no hormones. I can't make children, but was so understanding, so supportive that it just brought me having the BRCA gene and going through all these changes to really love myself more and appreciate who I am and what I am and how I carry myself. And we're together a year and my life has just changed. You know, I constantly remind myself of how do I want to be remembered, and with his support and love that he gives me, it's just brought me to a whole new level to appreciate life and how I feel about my body.
Do you feel like getting your positive test result at 21 made you or kind of encouraged you to rush into marriage, whereas otherwise you might have waited?
Yes, I definitely felt pressure. You know, again, I saw my family go through chemo, go through radiation. I didn't ever want my children to have to see me do that. So if I could be proactive and avoid that, that was the path that I chose.
Right. You had a daughter and then a son, and then you very quickly had both a mastectomy done and a total hysterectomy done. So by the time you were like 32, all those surgeries were behind you, right?
Correct.
That's a lot of stuff to do really fast, really young.
Yes. It happened very quickly. I look back now and I'm like, wow, the last 4.5 years of life has drastically changed.
When you were first diagnosed, you started with screenings. Did you have those screenings done with the same breast surgeon who'd ordered testing for you, or were you seen in a high-risk center? How did you go about having all of that screening done?
So my breast surgeon, again, was my surgeon since I'm 18 years old. I'm 37, so almost 20 years. So I just stuck with him the entire time. He always had my results within 24 hours. He called me over the phone. He was just an amazing supporter for me and just guided me through my tests and always told me, you know, if we have to take action quickly, we can do this.
Yeah. So it sounds like even though he wasn't there to actually give you the results and that was an RN, it's not like you felt dropped. Like he was the one overall who was providing you with care.
Correct. He provided me the top-notch care. I mean, I still refer to him all the time. I look at him like a father figure because, you know, he knew me when I was 18, graduating high school. Now he knows me after children. And, you know, he's watched me grown as well. Very supportive, very smart. He's actually part of the American Cancer Society. So he's always up to date on the latest and greatest, you know, information and what we can offer.
What was it like for you as a young woman to have those screenings done every 6 months for breast cancer risk?
It was probably one of the worst feelings I've had in my entire life, every 6 months, knowing, you know, I didn't know what I was up against, you know, going in, sitting in an MRI machine, exposing your body to all of these tests every 6 months, you know, it caused such stress. I was sick to my stomach days before. I had migraines. I was developing super bad anxiety. You know, am I going to be able to lay still in the machine? Are they going to capture the images that they need? What if they find something? It was always the what ifs. And those what ifs added up and caused so much stress on my body physically and mentally and emotionally.
I mean, a lot of women with BRCA mutations, I think, do elect to continue with screening, but it sounds like for you, you know, maybe after having two children, you were eager to be done with the screening part, at least.
I was eager to be done with the screening part again. You know, I had children. I wanted my children. I saw my grandmother go through radiation. I saw my grandfather have, you know, he lived with one lung. He had prostate cancer. I saw my other uncles have cancer. And, you know, I didn't want my children to see me go through that if I didn't have to. And I think that's so important that everybody has their own decision. But for me personally, I felt it would take a huge burden off my chest by my kids being able to hopefully see me live a healthy, fulfilled life.
How did that surgery go for you? I think for a lot of people, the recovery is pretty tough. And then with reconstruction, it adds extra steps. Is reconstruction something that you did too?
So first I had a hysterectomy robotically, which was an easy procedure. My mastectomy was a little rougher than I thought or I had planned. I basically had my mastectomy in December of 2015 and was part of the clinical trial for Aeroform. Great product. Unfortunately, my body built a seroma and some infection around it. I had to go in and have an emergency surgery. And I had a air expander and a saline expander. So I had two different expanders then. I was flat chested on one side for a little bit until we could, you know, start to expand and I was healing. And then I had a lot of nerve pain on my left side and lost a lot of range of motion for quite some time, which was a huge step back. And then I had my reconstruction 6 months later, which was great. So 2016, I had reconstruction. I was amazing. 2019, I split my pec muscle, which is I had animation deformity as well. So nobody ever advised me not to work out or how to work out or the weights that we should be doing. So my chest muscle, my pec muscle split, which happens to 58% of women that are not aware of it, and they live in constant pain. In April 2019, I had a revision. And during my revision, he repaired my pec muscle and sewed it back down, and I had implants put back in. And about 4 weeks after surgery in April, my pain was just unbearable. It had changed my life. I became this person I didn't know who I was, angry all the time, constant pain, no patience, you know, being a mom, wearing a compression garment, not being able to coach my children in their sports or be active. Like I went to the gym 5 days a week. I just said something's not right. And I went back to my surgeon and he's like, oh, let's just put nipples on and you'll feel better. And I said, no, there's really a problem going
that,
on.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to really correlate with your problem.
That doesn't help me. And he's like, well, your implants are 750 cc's. And I looked at him and said, I gave you what I wanted. You told me that if 750s could fit back in, it would be perfect. Mm-hmm. I said, okay. I left that in your hands in the OR. Kept going back to him, constant pain. In October, something just said, something's not right. I had a mastectomy 4 years ago. I was great. I was back to my normal life. Something's not right. I went for another opinion and ended up having another surgery in October. Come to find out, my scar tissue grew over my pec muscle and it was sitting on a nerve, which was causing all the pain. Mm. And both of my implants were flipped. So oh, wow. I had that removed and I had that fixed. And here I am actually 8 weeks later, doing a lot better, fully healed and out of pain.
Yeah, it's good to hear you're on the other side. But that's, you said the splitting the pec muscle, that's actually happens to like 50% of women who are not aware of it. So it sounds like it's not an uncommon 58%.
It's not uncommon. But the thing is, we're not educated enough. People are like, oh, you have pain, go on gabapentin or go to a pain management, I feel like we're not given the opportunity to look further into the situation mm-hmm. instead of just saying, here's medication. I'm not fond of medication at all, just like anybody else. And gabapentin is a strong nerve medication. And I didn't want to go that route. I just felt in my gut something wasn't right. So I was very happy that I got another opinion and I found the core of the problem, because women are in pain and there is pain syndrome associated with this. Having a mastectomy, obviously removing your nodes and removing everything from inside. But again, I don't think we're truly educated on there is animation deformity. You can really have other issues, but it's not really considered pain management. Let's look into what these issues are, and learning all about animation deformity and learning how to detect it. I think more women should be truly educated on that.
Yeah. So, and is that something, so in 2015, you created the BRCA Strong Facebook group, which then subsequently became a not-for-profit. So is that like one issue, for instance, now, or a new issue that that you're kind of do some advocacy around within that organization?
I am actually, I just did a video with my plastic surgeon actually explaining animation deformity and educating women, know your resources, know who to go to. If you go to a physician and you're not comfortable and your gut tells you, go for another opinion, go for that. Don't hesitate. It's your life. You have to have control of how you feel. And if somebody's telling you, oh, you're fine, but at the end of the day, you're not, I think that you should seek that. And knowledge is power. I'm a true advocate of knowing what's going on in your body. If you don't feel right and your body's telling you something, go with that. So we were focusing on new ways of reconstruction, animation deformity, pain management, just educating to let women know that there is other options out there.
Right. Is that a video that people can find online, like on YouTube or somewhere like that?
You will be able to find it. I'm actually sharing today. I have a social media post, and then we will have the long video up next week.
Great.
So it will be education and a resource for everybody to look at.
Okay. And that'll be on the BRCA Strong website?
Correct.
Okay, great. So we'll include a link to that in the show notes. So I kind of skipped over. So tell me what led you to create what was first that private Facebook group, BRCA Strong, and at what point were you in kind of like your treatments when you did that?
2 months before I started BRCA Strong on Facebook, it was like 2 months prior to my surgical journey. I felt like I was alone. Again, I was diagnosed pre-Angelina Jolie, where there was no like Basser focused, all of our big hospitals focused, but nobody really spoke about it as much. Or I felt very isolated. None of my friends, were BRCA positive. Nobody in my community spoke about it. I said, I'm just going to start this little group and see what happens. And, over time, we're 2,000 women nationwide. I started this group to help other women so they wouldn't get the feeling that I got in a situation, either a survivor or proviver or thriver. You never want to feel alone. I started this group as a positive influence to bring women together to talk about our problems, you know, to talk about if you're not happy and you're uncomfortable or you're going through a hard time, you don't have that support system at home, who can we lean on? And I felt that bringing our community together was a great idea. And I've grown again, you know, to 2,000 women nationwide, national. We speak all the time. We have positive feedback. We share our stories, our personal stories. And I feel like that has helped other women who are just starting in their journey or half or in their journey and are lost. Come there, talk, vent. We're here. It's 2-3 in the morning. You need to message me, message me. I don't ever want any woman to feel alone. And going through the process of the surgeries and sharing my story, I felt like we were missing how we feel whole again. What do we do? How do we remember who we are? One quote that I have always stuck to is, how do you want to be remembered? You know, losing a female body part was very hard, hard to accept. I said, what can we do that's different? So we decided to go ahead and make this where we fund women post-mastectomy garments that are pretty bras. Because, you know, when you're discharged from the hospital, you're given this big, bulky mastectomy bra, or you're wrapped up and you go home and poor me, or why me, or how can I feel whole, or do I feel less of a woman? Am I the same woman? So with that being said, I decided to take this, keep our stories going, and help other women feel whole again, because I knew what it was like to not feel whole and to lose my femininity. And I would never want anybody else to do that. So we focus on funding women again to help them feel whole. And I feel that I've touched so many women's lives in so many different aspects. And again, feeling whole as a woman on a day-to-day basis is a priority for any of us.
Yeah. And what, so how did it move for you from a private Facebook group where you're supporting women really like conversationally to something like broader where you, you know, you speak, and actually forming a non-for-profit?
So I actually got the chance, since I was in the clinical trial for Aeroform, to go to Capitol Hill and speak on the Patient Education Act, and hearing the Congress speak, and I just felt like we needed more in the community. And as I searched and began to look like what other nonprofits offer, like Susan G. Komen or all these other nonprofits offer research or offer rides or foods, or nobody again focused on feeling whole is how I felt. And I feel like that was just a big missing piece in our link that we need. So over time, I said, what can I do to be different? How can I impact other women that need support? And I just decided about 6 months after my mastectomy, this is what I want to do. I want to grow, and I want to support other women that are going through the same mission that I am.
Yeah. What helped you personally to feel whole?
Helping me feel
whole. I mean, it feels like that's like such a good goal, and it like sounds good and it feels good, but it's also kind of nebulous, you know?
You know, I wrote I had a lot of stickers on my mirrors, positive affirmations. I have an app on my phone that would remind me every day of a positive affirmation for myself. You go in and you put in all your information and it sends you positive affirmations. And I had them all over my mirror, as well as my little girl's 10 years old, but 4 years ago when I started my journey, she was just a huge part of BRCA Strong. And that's actually how BRCA Strong was created, was through my daughter. And as you look at our logo, it's a transformation of butterflies. You know, you go through different phases of life. And my daughter referred to me as a butterfly. So as I went through that transition, Mommy, you're so beautiful. You're like a butterfly. You went through different phases and you're back to being whole again. That just made me at the end of the day feel so amazing. And I felt that I could put that on to the next person. In my heart, I said, wow, you know, that's so deep for a little six-year-old to say. That needs to be passed on to the next person.
We'll be back with patient stories in just a minute.
Have you ever wondered how your own family medical history might impact your personal health risks? Or maybe you're wondering if you'd be a good candidate for genetic testing, but you aren't quite ready to commit to a full genetic counseling session. Our Family History Review is perfect for those seeking more information and guidance before making an appointment with a genetic counselor. Simply answer a few questions about your personal and family medical history, and a certified genetic counselor will review it and return a written evaluation right to your email inbox in 3 to 5 business days. They will also provide you with a personalized risk assessment and even recommend to you what your next steps could be. Check out this service and more on greygenetics.com. That's G-R-E-Y genetics.com.
So you had a hysterectomy done when you were only 32, is that right?
That's correct.
And you had your uterus removed as well as your ovaries?
Yes, and my fallopian tubes.
What led you to do that at such a young age? Because that is like quite young for someone with a BRCA2 mutation and no family history of really early onset ovarian cancer to have that surgery done.
I felt that if I had my ovaries removed first, I was at a less chance for breast cancer. There was no estrogen coming. Again, 5 years ago, they're still really... they were up in the air about even using HRTs. You know, I think things have changed so much, yet I feel like I did it at a very early age. I don't regret doing it because I know I'm now at a lesser risk. I feel like I was not given enough education on that because here I am at 37 facing complications due to not having hormones. I have severe osteoporosis. And I feel like my day-to-day life has drastically changed without hormones in my body.
Yeah.
I don't regret anything, right? But I feel like, again, education, I could have been more educated in that area and maybe took a different avenue on that surgery.
Yeah. Did you see a GYN oncologist who did that surgery for you a general surgeon or...
I saw a gynecological oncologist, and at that time, he was not doing robotic hysterectomy. So he referred me to a gynecologist who was doing robotic, and I had it done by a GYN.
Okay. And did either of those physicians talk to you about the effects of removing your ovaries and like what kind of adjustments you might have to go through or what kind of risks that would bring for your health, like unrelated to cancer?
So they did talk about osteoporosis a little bit. They did not talk about my quality of life, my day to day without hormones. And I think that was a huge part that was missed. I was not educated on. And I wish I was more educated because, again, you know, we think, you know, women go through menopause when we get older. You know, we think it's going to be that, but it's really not. It's a totally different outlook. You know, you go in for surgery and you go into surgical menopause. Well, it hits you and that's it. You go through hot flashes. You go through changes. You know, go through vaginal dryness, which nobody talks about. I'm still young. Again, I wish that I would have known a little more on the hysterectomy side. For sure, to be educated, you know, our quality of life definitely changes without hormones.
Yeah. I interviewed a Georgia Hurst recently who has Lynch syndrome, and, you know, there's a risk for ovarian cancer with Lynch syndrome as well as uterine cancer, but it's much lower than for BRCA mutation carriers. But, you know, similarly feels like she wasn't really given enough information about the effects of removing the ovaries. And she pointed out to me that I'd never really thought about, like, we use the term surgical menopause, but it's really a misnomer because menopause is a gradual process and there's nothing gradual about suddenly having your ovaries taken out.
Correct.
Yeah. So have you been on hormone replacement therapy, or is there anything that you found that helps alleviate those symptoms, or how do you manage that day to day at this point in your life?
So it's been a very frustrating experience. I was given bioidentical hormones, the pellets, and about 7 months after I had my hysterectomy, my breast surgeon was like, don't do it. My GYN's like, we can try and see what happens. I actually happened to have a very adverse event to the testosterone where I went into like a very bad state of mind, wouldn't leave the house, very depressed. If I wasn't depressed, I was very aggressive. So at this time I've decided not to take any hormones, to stay off of them and just try to manage my day-to-day life. I do believe I'm on a vitamin now called Rainbow. It has helped me a little bit. My hot flashes come and go. I do use peppermint essential oil, peppermint soap, which I have found to help me drastically. But that's really it. You know, it's a day-to-day fight. I find foods that I can't have, red sauce, red wine, are all trigger my hot flashes. So, you know, now I monitor more what I eat. My body's changed. You know, our hips spread. We've gained weight. So these are all things that I'm trying to battle and live through on a day-to-day basis. You know, I just got cleared to work out again. So now, hopefully being working out, you know, I'll get my body more in shape, but our bodies have changed and there's really nothing else that I would do at this time because I feel like I don't want to give my body estrogen because I've removed my chances. Why put something back in my body that could hurt me?
Mm-hmm. And do you have either your breast surgeon or the GYN you saw who did your surgery? Do you have any physicians who are really helpful in walking you through this and the different options?
I do. I actually have a breast oncologist that I work very close with BRCA Strong also, who I call and I get advice from. I see her, you know, she says 0.5 milligrams of estrogen won't hurt you. Then you go on and you read all this clinical data and there's really nothing out there that says it's not going to hurt you. So for me, if I can make it through the struggles that I have, I'd like to continue. I do want my patients back, you know, for my children and my life, but that's just the thing you have to work on. I feel like giving my body something that's not meant to be there anymore is like a 50-50 for me. So I'm not okay with taking it right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And from your work with BRCA Strong, do you have the impression that things have changed since you had your hysterectomy done, that women are given better information now, and more, you know, more informed about the risks of having their ovaries removed and what health concerns that might bring on and reasons to possibly delay? Or do you feel like it's really hasn't changed from when you had your surgery done and women are still getting the surgery done and kind of surprised about the effects of not having their ovaries anymore?
So I think that there is more information available than there was almost 5 years ago. I still feel like we're not truly educated in that department and need to get more education. And medical technology has definitely advanced. I mean, for me, I can say I'm a huge advocate of clinical trials. I know there are some clinical trials going on right now for BRCA and hormone therapy, or if you're BRCA, I know there's a lot of different clinical trials. So I suggest for women, for us to continue to move forward and not let women go through what we went through, is to participate in these clinical trials to help other women so they don't face what we face.
Yeah.
And I know they're offered all over, you know, from New York to Florida to California. There's even some online that you can do. And I feel that clinical research is so important in our community. Let's make a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not guinea pigs. We're people here to help other women along the line. I look at it as, you know, I have a little girl, I have a little boy who are both at 50% of chance for this gene. If we can help them where they don't have to go through a hysterectomy or a mastectomy, let's do that. Let's continue to make a difference.
Yeah. Are there clinical trials, the clinical trials that you're aware of, that you're thinking about, are those for women who've already had their ovaries removed to try out treatments, or is that more for women who are thinking of having an oophorectomy done to do it like under some sort of research protocol so that they're looking more carefully at side effects? Or what do clinical trials have to offer women specifically related to oophorectomy-related risks?
So there's both available. Like right now, I know they're doing a program in University of Miami for women who are BRCA positive who have not had a hysterectomy or oophorectomy yet versus women who are BRCA positive and had a hysterectomy or oophorectomy or both. I will send it to you.
Okay, great. Okay, we'll include that in show notes for listeners who are interested in checking that out. And you mentioned your children are both at 50% risk of carrying the same BRCA2 mutation. You said your daughter's 10 years old and your son is younger, right?
Correct.
Seven. What, at that age, what do they understand about BRCA, if anything? Like, what have you talked to them about, and how have you talked to them about this?
So my daughter was six when it started, and I explained to her, you know, I was going in for a hysterectomy, went into a little bit of detail. I am a big advocate of Proactive Genes, the book. That book has helped my family tremendously on explaining to children the genes and, you know, like what mommies go through. So I basically explained to her, you know, I was going in, I was going to have a procedure done, and I was going to come home and be fine. And thank God with my hysterectomy, that is what happened. You know, at 6 years old, I didn't realize how much she can process. Now, 2 days ago, this conversation came up and she's learning about uteruses and fallopian tubes in school and asked me a question. And I had to explain to her, you know, I had a hysterectomy. I can't make any more children. I don't have any more hormones. And to her, she said to me, you know, mommy, why? What if you want more kids? And I just said to her, you know, at this time in my life, I've been blessed with two amazing children. And I really wanted her to know that, you know, cancer is a risk in our family, and I wanted to be proactive. And that's what I decided to do. For my mastectomy, I went into a little more detail and explained to her, you know, I had my two children, I nursed them, I was blessed to have that opportunity, and now it was time again to take preventative action because breast cancer runs in our family. And as she's getting older, she's asking more questions, you know, do I have risk for this gene? When do I get tested? What can I do to avoid getting this gene? So as much as I can, I try to explain to her, but, you know, when you look at a little 10-year-old girl, you're explaining, you know, what you've gone through in life. I try to prepare her, but I don't want to scare her, so I do back up at some times.
Yeah.
You know, it's overwhelming. You know, what do you want to tell your children? How much detail do you want to go into? Do you want to scare the poop out of her and tell her, you know, she could have cancer or she could have this gene? I feel, again, that so much has advanced in our since my diagnosis of BRCA, what they're working on for the future, the screenings that they do. You know, I work very closely with my gene counsel. You know, I uploaded my results there. So we get constant updates on how to screen and what to do, or working with, you know, the vaccine of the future or an oral medication. So I try to stay very informed in that aspect so I can guide my children the right way, because no, I don't want my daughter getting genetic testing at 21 to be told, you know, rush your life, have children, get married. You know, I think that in 10 years from now, there's going to be a totally different avenue to take than the avenue that I took. Or I pray that there's a different avenue to take, you know?
Yeah, we're definitely going to be, it's hard to know that's so far out, but it's like definitely reasonable to think it's not going to be the same situation.
Correct. So.
And what about your son at 7 years old? Does he ask about any of this at all? Or the Proactive Genes book that you mentioned, is that something that you've read with him?
I've read that book with him as well. You know, my kids saw me go through a very big struggle this year for about almost 9 months. So it's definitely affected my son, and he just keeps saying, mommy, I want you back to your normal life. I want you coaching my games. I want you playing soccer with me. I think it's affected my son a little more emotionally because he's seen the struggle where I was always so active with them for the first, you know, his first 5 years of life. And then all of a sudden life changed for him. He just says, I want your arms to move. That's all he asks for. He doesn't ask.
Oh.
He doesn't ask me questions on why. I think that it all happened so quick that he didn't have time to process it like my daughter did. I think he's still right on the younger side to actually understand it.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
But that book, I mean, Proactive Genes, changed both of my kids' life. Like the way it's explained to them in a child's perspective, you know, my background's medical. You know, how do I sit down and explain to my children this is what I'm going through? I can explain it, but when you put it in kids' terms, I think it really changes the way they look at it and their view.
Yeah. And Proactive Genes, we actually have them listed as a resource on our website, and we'll include them in the show notes too. So you can order the book It looks like on their website, you can, for bulk orders, you email them, but otherwise they just have a link to Amazon. How did you find that book? Did a doctor point it out to you or another BRCA carrier? Or did you just find it on your own?
I actually posted a picture. My daughter, I've kind of made Feel It on the First, you know, like a joke in our house, kind of like, let's make sure we always examine our bodies. I shouldn't say a joke, but I've kind of made it where on the first of the month, you know, we check our bodies. And I did a picture with my daughter of saying, like, do a check, you know, like check yourself. And Shannon had just posted, the author of the book had posted, and we had just collaborated. And I said, she's like, let me send you one. I think it was like her first week of book launch. And she sent me one, and it really changed the view again of my daughter's life and of how. And she's done a couple of videos, my daughter expressing how she feels and sharing her story as, you know, the watching her mother go through this.
Yeah.
So I was just by luck hopping, you know, posting on social media constantly all the time, sharing my kids' view, my view. And I met Shannon and just felt like, wow. I still tag her in all of our posts. We share her book. You know, I think that anybody, a provider, a survivor, a thriver, to have this book to explain to their children or have our schools educate our children on our bodies, on our ancestors, on our life, on our genes, is just so important. Not important, it's imperative. Some of our kids, you know, their families can't afford testing or they can't even afford mammograms. Let's educate children so they can go home to tell their moms, you know, we need to get checked on the first, you know, or we need to check our bodies, make sure they're normal, make sure nothing's changed.
Seems like you've done a really good job talking to your kids about that. I could also see a scenario where kids are like overly anxious, you know, like thinking about these risks from a really young age.
And I think that does play a huge impact because, you know, listen, my daughter, like I said, she's recently asking me questions, you know, she's 10 years old. I don't want that to be a worry for her. I want her to be able to live her most best life she can ever live and not have to worry about this. But again, this is something that everybody faces, unfortunately. It's sad that this is what we have to deal with in our society, but we can't change life, you know? So it's like, do we educate or do we not educate? Sometimes I'm like, not going to tell her this because, you know, it could be overwhelming.
Well, it seems like, I mean, in her case, she's coming to you with questions, you know? So it's not something where you're deciding to give her this, you know, in-depth talk at 10 years old, like she's coming to you with specific questions and you're responding to them. So that makes a lot of sense. You'd mentioned before that you actually, you know, you didn't see a genetic counselor initially after you received your BRCA2 mutation result, but you did meet with one later. When and how and why did that happen later?
So it was about 6.5 years later after I got my testing. Angelina Jolie came out a couple years after me. And I think once she told her story, you know, and shared genetic counseling, all the genetic counselors, I feel like kind of came out. And then I saw my oncologist who then guided me to say, you know, let's go talk to the genetic counselor, see what she has to say, see what kind of information you get. And I actually saw a genetic counselor and felt I was very overwhelmed. And I never forget leaving that practice and her saying, you know, there's a 1% chance you have a false positive, and I think you should get retested. And I had paid $3,000 and fought my insurance, you know, to get this test approved. And I said, wow, this is what she's telling me. I'm not sure what to do or where to go. And then I actually came across My Gene Counsel and their platform, mm-hmm. and spoke to them and got, you know, my report back and felt what I was doing was right. And the information that the genetic counselor had given me that I had seen in person, I felt like based on my genes, based on my family history, I have the result. What are the chances that I put myself back through this and it's not positive and I'm going to get a negative result? I'm going to be disappointed because it's putting myself through the anxiety of going more for blood work and going through this again. I felt that I didn't really benefit from her, and I benefited about a couple years ago when I spoke and submitted online and got a phone call by color and my gene counsel, I truly felt that I was more educated at that point than I was with the genetic counselor that I had met in person.
I'm really very surprised to hear that this genetic counselor told you you had a 1% chance of a false positive. Did she say why she thought that, or was that, you know, based on some family history details or the specifics of your report from the laboratory?
So basically, you know, when you fight insurance, sometimes the samples are held longer and they're not run right away. And my sample sat there, I believe, for like a week and a half or 2 weeks. And again, being in the medical field, knowing a lot of people in the medical field, she was the only person that told me that. And I felt like, here I am, I've gone through everything now. You're the last person that I've seen. You know, I saw a gynecological oncologist, an oncologist, a breast oncologist, a plastic surgeon, and nobody had said that to me. And I said, I was just very overwhelmed at the way she spoke to me. I didn't feel she was caring and loving. It was she kept going back to the 1%. And obviously, as you and I know, 1% is nothing, right? So I felt overwhelmed.
I was going to say 1% is high. I feel like, relative to what I think would be the true possibility of you having an inaccurate test result, I'm just like very surprised.
I was very surprised. I was very taken back. My mom was in the room with me, and knowing my family history and everything, I was really already had my mind made up because I didn't see the genetic counselor for so many years on what I was going to do, that at this point, I kind of just brushed her off and was like, it's not a big deal, but didn't think of it from like, she didn't talk about how now, you know, they're doing embryos, they're doing so you don't pass the gene on. You know, I wasn't given any of that information.
Right, right. Which would have been, especially since you already had your test result, which I don't know from, you know, I don't have your records, but there's not a clear reason to me that there'd be a reason to doubt that. That would be the way she could have been most helpful to you was probably talking to you about those other options. You know, I'm disappointed to hear when people don't have a good experience with genetic counseling, but I like to hear about it. And there's a lot of genetic counselors who listen to this podcast. And I think you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I'm sure that genetic counselor didn't hear from you that it was a bad experience, but it's nice for other people to hear about that. And like with, you know, I think a lot of the time most of the time when people see a genetic counselor, they see someone, you know, who's certified, who knows what they're talking about, and they get good information. But just like with a physician, like it can be something where if what someone's saying to you, what a genetic counselor says to you doesn't sit well, like a reason to get another opinion, you know, to meet with someone else. So,
And that's one of the reasons, you know, I worked with my gene counsel in color. And I mean, I have to say that I really a big shout out to color, you know, the way they call you, the way you go over your results. I mean, at the end of the call, I'll never forget hanging up with the genetic counselor, Lily. I was like, I'm floored right now. Like, I wish that I was given this advice and all this information, you know, prior to doing what I did.
Prior to testing or
prior to surgeries or both? I had already had my surgeries at this time. I just think that it might have changed my life a little bit in the perspective for sure of a hysterectomy. I was blown away of, you know, so many, and maybe you can relate or elaborate a little bit more on this, but you know, when you're diagnosed BRCA, you know, it's either remove your ovaries first or remove your breast first, you know, and I was pushed so much more towards your hysterectomy and oophorectomy. But really, when I hung up with color, it was more of, you didn't have to rush to do that. Like, because of your family history, it was a later onset where I was never educated on that. And I feel that from a genetics counselor standpoint, that's a huge piece of information, especially for somebody who's 32 years old.
And I don't know off the top of my head what guidelines were saying about 5 years ago, but, you know, generally the timing for removing the ovaries is somewhere between like 40 and 45, like maybe closer to 45 for someone with BRCA2, like you have closer to 40 breast cancer with BRCA1 mutation. And of course, family history factors in. And then some people, you know, just like everybody feels differently about those risks, but 32 is incredibly young, you know, to have those surgeries done. How did the genetic counselor from color talk to you that was different from the other genetic counselor? I mean, obviously it seems like she gave you more information that was more helpful and relevant to you. But you also said that the other genetic counselor you'd spoken with initially, who your oncologist referred you to, didn't seem very warm. Like, what, I'm just wondering more about like how they interacted with you that was so different.
When they call you, they go over basically like your entire family history, you know, from my ancestors, you know, that were Ashkenazi Jew descent, to working its way down up until my youngest aunt that passed away. The questions that they asked, you know, what kind of breast cancer, the age of breast cancer, the age of ovarian cancer, the prostate cancer, lung cancer. She made a quote to me, and I can't remember now.
And did the first genetic counselor you see not do that, not get that complete family history?
She asked me for my family history, but never asked me, were we Ashkenazi Jew descent, which I now know and knew a couple years ago, plays a huge role in the BRCA gene.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if she, like, she had your medical records already from, you know, if she's in the same health system as your oncologist, she just like wasn't asking you information you'd already provided to him.
That's what I feel like. I feel like she just wasn't as informative, and all the questions that were asked and the process of what it, you know, to go through of, you know, well, if this family member has it and this family member has it and this family member, and you come together with your DNA and this is what your risks are. They just brought it to me and proposed it to me in a different perspective and gave me a better feeling of comfort of, yes, I have this gene, you don't have cancer, and these are the measures that you can take and the avenues that you can go. Not telling me what to do, but gave me my different options, which was different than what the genetic counselor here told me. Basically, one of the options I'll never forget leaving was, well, just go on tamoxifen. And I'm like, but I want kids. Why would I go on tamoxifen so young if I don't have cancer? And I feel like that was a very big push on her part, was more of just go on tamoxifen, mm-hmm. where I didn't want to do that.
Yeah. And I think that's a difference between different genetic counselors too. Like some, well, I'll say like for me, I don't touch questions about tamoxifen because I'm not a physician, I'm not an oncologist. And I say, you know, I'll like mention what's in the guidelines and say that, you know, if I were talking to you, like, you should ask your physician to talk to you about this, but I'm not going to give some advice related to tamoxifen or any other medication.
And she just kept pushing it. And it threw me off really big because I had already known my grandmother was on it. She had radiation. Then they had to stop it because she was, you know, she wasn't a candidate, and I felt like she was throwing that more at me. And then she said, well, you should get a mastectomy before you get a hysterectomy and an oophorectomy. And I'm like, wait, I just totally got different. I got very different opinions from the geneticist to the oncologist, which was very overwhelming at 21 years old.
Wait, because it was, you were still 21 when you were actually referred to the genetic counselor by your oncologist?
So I think I was like 24 or 25 when I saw the geneticist.
Okay. All right. Or was it a genetic counselor? Was it a geneticist? Like there are medical doctors, physicians who do to your fellowship in our geneticists?
It was a true geneticist.
Okay. Okay. That makes me, I mean, I have a high opinion of most geneticists, but that does make me look at it a little differently, that this wasn't a genetic counselor who misinformed you.
No, it wasn't. It was a geneticist. It's interesting because, again, I'm in the medical field, and genetic counselors and geneticists, I always thought were, you know, very similar until this situation came up. And I'm like, wow, it's very different.
Yeah, I think the terms are confusing for people. Like I hear people say geneticist sometimes, and on this podcast too, sometimes I know they mean genetic counselor and sometimes I'm not sure. So yeah, geneticist is for someone who has a PhD in genetics. Within people who practice medicine, it's someone who's has their medical degree. Most often they've done a residency in pediatrics, but it could be in something else. Like it could be in OBGYN or whatever. And then they do a 2-year fellowship on top of that. They have a lot more training than we do in medicine. Like they can actually, you know, for pediatric genetics, they're really invaluable because they're doing physical exams and they just like have a really deep knowledge of medicine that they bring to the table. And then as genetic counselors, it's a 2-year master's degree. We're not physicians and we don't prescribe medications and we don't give medical advice. So often we work work really well together, but we definitely have different training and perspective. I don't know, it could depend too, you know, there's not, I would say the majority of geneticists probably work in pediatrics and don't really have that cancer specialty. That's definitely not true for everyone. Like a lot of people are really expert, but you know, possibly you saw someone who is informative in other areas, but not related to hereditary cancer genetics. What would you say to someone who is listening, thinking about their family history of breast cancer or other BRCA-related cancers and has thought about testing, but is just hesitant to move forward with it, isn't sure that they want to deal with that information and all the decisions that follow, or someone who's had testing done, knows they carry a mutation, but they just are feeling really alone?
So if you know you have the mutation and you feel you're alone, I suggest that you reach out to some of our support groups. You know, being diagnosed can be overwhelming. And it's, where do you go with this information? Are you going to take preventative action? Are you going to just do screenings? It's a very personal decision. For example, my mom, you know, has watched me go through this. She's like, I'm not getting tested. And I say to her, why don't you want to get tested? And her answer is, well, I'm not brave enough like you. I'm not going to take preventative action. You know, I'm 70 years old. What am I going to do? So my advice to somebody that doesn't want to get tested is just make sure that you do your screenings, make sure you do your monthly exams at home, know your body, knowledge is power, stay on top of it, don't skip your mammogram yearly. If you feel a change, make sure you go to the doctor. If you're listening and you haven't got tested and you have a strong family history, you're Ashkenazi Jew descent, and you are willing to take the chance to get tested to find out that you're positive or negative. And if you find out you're positive, doesn't mean you have to take the surgical route like I did. I was under surveillance for 12 years and then decided to take preventative action. And if you are positive, just make sure you have your blood work, you have your mammos, you have your MRI, you have your ultrasounds. And if you feel a change or do your monthly exams, make sure you reach out to your physicians. I don't regret anything that I have done with the BRCA gene. I knew over time things would change and medical technology and all of this would change, but it's knowing your body, knowing your options, seeing different physicians, getting guidance. If it means you just want to get monitored, join a clinical trial, just stay on top of your body. Listen to your family history, follow your pattern of genes throughout, you know, your life. Look back. Don't just go to your grandmother. Look back several generations. See what's there. If you're not interested in getting testing, just know that you have options out there.
If you'd like to share your story, send an email to podcast@graygenetics.com.
Patient Stories is an ad-free podcast and is unaffiliated with any commercial genetic testing laboratories. We would like to keep it that way. You can now donate to Patient Stories online by going to graygenetics.com/podcast/donate. If you don't want to make a monetary donation but still want to support the show in another way, leaving a review on iTunes or sharing our episodes through social media also makes a big difference.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.